Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Recently, a fishing guide friend, Matt Squillante, recommended a book to me called The Rescue Effect and told me that the author, Michael Meta Webster, would be an excellent fit for our show. So I read the book and thoroughly enjoyed it and decided that a conversation with Michael was definitely in order. Michael Meta Webster is a professor of practice in the Department of Environmental Studies at New York University. His 2022 book, The Rescue Effect, The Key to Saving Life on Earth, chronicles the ways that nature works to restore and maintain itself. In a time when climate change and habitat loss are increasingly making the future for life on Earth look bleak, Webster's book offers hope tempered with realism. He joins us now to talk about it. Michael Meta Webster, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I really found this book very intriguing. A mutual friend of ours, Matt Squillante, pointed it out to me, and I found this book to be really fascinating. I'd like to know, you know, what led you down the path to investigate this thing you call the rescue effect?
Well, first of all, thank you. I'm glad that you found the book fascinating. For me, I think this book has been brewing in me for a long time, and part of it has to do with having worked in conservation, on conservation issues for many years. I think one of the things that happens in the conservation world is that we get really sort of caught up in a lot of the negative stories and a lot of the sort of doom and gloom. And there's plenty of reason for that, right? If you care about nature, there's plenty of things happening that are bad news. But I'm trained as an ecologist and I've worked in conservation a long time. And sometimes I think that we overemphasize the negatives and we sometimes don't give nature sort of enough credit for its ability to deal with environmental change and recover. And, you know, I've worked on coral reefs for a long time, which are one of arguably the most imperiled ecosystems on the world. But even on coral reefs, I think there's some reasons to look at what's happening and find some room for optimism. And so for me, the book was partly as I was looking at my colleagues and looking at people who really cared about nature and seeing them feeling, I think, very sort of demoralized and disheartened. And when I would talk to them about what was going on ecologically and why things may not be as bad as they might seem on the surface, I found that people were often, they often responded to that very well. And I realized that there was a message here about what's happening in nature that is distinct from the sort of the gloom and doom side of the equation that's also important. And we should be talking about that too.
Could you explain what the rescue effect actually is?
To me, there's, when you look at nature, say a species that lives in a particular place, it's always experiencing changes in its environment. Maybe one year there's a drought, or another year there's a fire, or for a period of years the temperature is warmer or colder than usual. And what is really important in nature is that species and organisms, they have abilities for dealing with environmental change. And in the book, that's what I call the rescue effect. It's this sort of collective set of, you know, ecological processes, if you want to use sort of the scientific term, that together make this sort of automatic response where species, individuals, they respond to change in ways that help them to cope with that change. So that's what the rescue effect is overall. And in my book, what I've done is I've broken it down into sort of six different processes in nature.
So it's kind of like, it. Correct me if I'm wrong here, I have the sense that all of these things that nature does, it's almost like an immune system response to try to fix things.
Yeah, in some cases, so an immune system is like a positive feedback where your, say, body detects change and then does something actively about it. And some of the parts of the rescue effect do work like that. In other cases, it's just chance that there's enough things going on in nature that by chance, some organisms, for example, find themselves in a new location where maybe they didn't live before, but conditions are now good. So it's a combination of those sort of immune responses as well as just chance events that collectively help organisms to respond to change.
Well, can you lead us through the six different forms of rescue effect that nature has the tools for?
Sure. And let's just do them one at a time. Let's start with demographic rescue. When you look at a species in nature, usually it's not found in just one place. Usually there's many different populations. Maybe if it's something that lives in a forest and different patches of forest, you find groups of these organisms. And what happens in demographic rescue is that there's immigration and emigration between populations. So if one population is small, maybe runs into some bad luck and maybe gets a disease or something and the population declines. Demographic rescue can help recover that population because it represents an influx of new individuals from some other place. And that influx can be really important for populations, keeping them from going extinct and keeping them persisting in the environment.
And then the next one's called reproductive rescue effect. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, reproductive rescue is one of the most common things we see in nature. Left to their own devices, most populations will arrive at something that we think of as a carrying capacity. That in nature, there's a certain number of individuals for a given species that an environment can hold. If the population gets bigger than that, something tends to happen and the population will come down. In reproductive rescue, this is when a population gets knocked down to a level that's below its carrying capacity. What usually happens in those situations is that the organisms that have survived find themselves to be in an environment that's got less competition, whether that's competition for food or territories or mates, and they actually find the conditions to be quite good. And in response, they have higher rates of reproduction, or their offspring may survive better, so that the population then tends to go up in size. This is actually what fisheries are based on. The whole idea around fisheries around the world is that if you catch some fish from a population, you lower the population, you reduce things like competition, and that the population then actually has more reproduction. That excess reproduction is what, in fisheries terms, is targeted for catching in the next generation. So reproductive rescue is the fundamental idea behind fisheries, but it works in most populations. Usually every time you get some sort of population decline, you'll often get a response by that population where the reproductive rate will go up.
Okay, and the next one is called genetic. So how does genetic rescue work?
So genetic rescue is dealing with the problem of inbreeding. So when you get a really small population that's isolated in some location, what happens over time is that as individuals mate, increasingly they're starting to mate with relatives. You know, if a population is only a couple dozen individuals, it's hard to mate with somebody who's not your cousin after a few generations. And there's some problems in genetics when closely related organisms mate with each other. It produces some problems that can be detrimental. And so that's when that happens, the population is referred to as inbred. In genetic rescue, it's the same mechanism as demographic rescue, where a few individuals come in from the outside. But in this case, what they're bringing with them is new genes into that population, new genetic combinations. And that can be really important for an inbred population. It can sort of breathe new genetic life into that population. So that immigration of a new individual can help get that population going again genetically.
Well, and this term I remember from many years ago taking biology, phenotypes. Talk about that type of rescue and explain what phenotypes are.
Yeah, so a phenotype, the simplest definition of a phenotype is sort of what an organism looks like. And what it really is, it's getting at the idea that every organism has a unique genetic code, and that genetic code gets expressed differently in different environments. For example, a tree, the same tree, if it were to grow in a dark forest bottom versus an open grassland, would probably grow at very different rates. Even if it had the same genetic combination, one situation would probably grow taller, one situation would probably grow slower, et cetera. And so that difference in how an individual reacts to its environment, that produces the phenotype, which is the appearance of the organism or which genes are turned on or its physiology at any given time. And the phenotype of individuals can change over time. For example, you know, if you decide to go on a big exercise regimen, it might change your amount of body fat. It might change your amount of muscle in your body. In that case, you've got different genes on. You're also resulting in a different phenotype. And so all organisms have the ability to shift phenotypes under different conditions. And it's sort of often the first line of defense for dealing with environmental change. The phenotype changes in response to those environmental conditions. And it can change almost immediately. It can change over a period of months or even years. But that kind of response is an individual response of essentially an individual organism using its genetic code in a different way.
Okay. And then the next one is geographic, which sounds pretty simple. How does that work?
Yeah, so this is one of those ones that I was referring to earlier that's often sort of a statistical process. Most organisms, when they reproduce, some of their offspring travel away from where the parents are found. And in that process, they have the ability to find new places where the parents didn't live. Now, if the environment is really stable, usually that's a bad idea. for example, you don't want to wind up far from your parents and into an environment where maybe you're not well suited to live. And so what happens is that most species tend to be found in a particular geographic range that's often related to the climate in that area. Right now, what we're seeing is that climate is changing so quickly that organisms are increasingly finding themselves in places that are not necessarily a good match, even though their parents or their grandparents may have lived in that environment. But if they go through some sort of dispersal phase, think of like a seed being blown in the wind or a bird flying to a new location, what can happen is that they can find new places that didn't used to be good for that species, but are good now. Today, we've got lots and lots of species that are doing things like moving poleward. So in the Northern Hemisphere, they're tending to move north in latitude. On mountainsides, they're tending to move higher in elevation. And that's a sign that the environment is changing and the organisms are shifting where they're found. And they're doing this by sampling new environments through dispersal. And some of them are getting lucky. They're winding up in places that are sort of maybe new for the species, but are good for it going forward.
Yes. And then we've observed that a lot here in California, like in Lassen Volcanic National Park, with species, you know, just moving up to try to, you know, escape the heat that's lower down. It's very interesting to see and a little disturbing. Okay, then the sixth one is evolutionary.
Yeah, so this is really just survival of the fittest. We generally think of evolution as something that happens really slowly. Like you can imagine birds evolving from dinosaurs over tens or hundreds of millions of years. And a lot of evolution does work very slowly. But evolution can also occur really, really quickly. And what happens is in evolutionary rescue is that a population or a species is faced with environmental change, and that environmental change is so harsh that it kills off some individuals. If the ones that survive survived because they have some genetic combination that makes them better at surviving, in that moment, evolution has occurred because the surviving organisms look different genetically than they did before whatever caused their death. Now, if that begins to happen in a population quickly, what can happen is you can get very, very rapid evolution. So there's examples where people have seen things like snakes in Australia evolving the ability to avoid poisonous cane toads that were introduced, you know, some decades in the past. It's very rapid evolution that if the organism isn't able to do it, it would probably go extinct. And so we're seeing more and more examples around the world of evolutionary rescue, which is this sort of very rapid evolutionary response to changing environments.
Yeah. And one of the big takeaways for me from your book is, and already kind of knew this, but just you make it quite clear, is that we humans are changing things on Earth so much and moving species around, whether we mean to or whether, you know, it'd be accidental. The idea of invasive species, that they're being moved everywhere, and some are winners and some are losers in that game.
And I think that sort of framing that you just did around winners and losers is a pretty applicable one for species and populations all over the world. As our environments are changing more and more, some organisms are doing really, really well, and some are doing really badly. And a lot of it has to do with sort of the strength and the details of the rescue effect in terms of whether their population is able to withstand the environmental change. And like I said, some species are doing very well in response to the conditions that we've created. And you're also mentioning moving species around. That's been happening, you know, in ways that have never occurred on our planet before in terms of the pace and the distance that things are moving. So we're creating lots and lots of new combinations of species that have never existed in the past. And we're going through a process of those species interacting and sort of figuring out what these ecosystems are going to look like in the future.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Michael Medha-Webster, author of The Rescue Effect, The Key to Saving Life on Earth. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our conversation with our guest, Michael Medha-Webster. Michael is a professor of environmental studies at New York University and the author of the 2022 book, The Rescue Effect, The Key to Saving Life on Earth. In it, Webster lays out the ways that nature seeks to restore itself and preserve species diversity whenever ecosystems experience disruptions. One of the things I really enjoyed about the book is that you kind of lay out these different forms of the rescue effect, which we just went through, the six different kinds. And then you give these wonderful, fascinating examples all over the world. So we can't do all of them, but I'd like to pick out some I found particularly interesting. Let's start with salmon up in Alaska, the story of the sockeye salmon, because I found that to be really quite interesting. Tell us about your experience with your son in the sockeye salmon.
Sure. And I lived in the Pacific Northwest for a long time. And while I was there, I, you know, sort of fell in love with salmon, but you know, you never saw more than a few of them here or there in rivers in the Northwest. And when I started working on salmon conservation in places like British Columbia and Alaska, I just couldn't get over how many salmon were in those streams. And the reality is there's a lot of salmon today. Not nearly as many as there used to be in the Pacific Northwest, but a lot of places in the farther north, in Russia, in Alaska and British Columbia, are doing very well. Certainly not all of them, but many. The story you're talking about is in Bristol Bay, Alaska. So Bristol Bay is a region in western Alaska. If you can picture Alaska and sort of the Alaskan Peninsula, which breaks out into those Aleutian Islands that spread across the northern Atlantic, Bristol Bay is just north of that. So it flows into the Bering Sea. And this place is probably the best habitat for sockeye salmon in the world. And it's a really interesting story because, you know, we often think of fisheries as being a negative for different populations, that they sort of inevitably lead to overfishing and the decline of the species that are subject to fisheries. That's absolutely not been the case for sockeye salmon, which have been fished by people for thousands of years. Large-scale commercial fisheries started in about the late 1800s. And so there have been very large-scale commercial fisheries up in that area for about 125 years. And recent years have been showing record returns. And so it's an interesting story where we can sort of see that fisheries don't inevitably lead to decline. And on top of it, these highly fished populations are doing exceptionally well. Now, one of the reasons that they've been doing well this whole time has been reproductive rescue, which we talked about before. People have been studying that system for a long time, and they've tried to sort of titrate how many salmon do you want in the watershed spawning in order to produce the strongest year class of salmon in the future. And so there's a lot of work that's been done on reproductive rescue in that system, which has been arguably pretty successful over this time period, which has led to the population continuing to be strong. But that's not the only thing that keeps this system resilient. You've got lots and lots of different populations that are supporting each other through things like demographic rescue that we talked about earlier, as well as genetic rescue. And so you've got a system that has all these mechanisms built in it that allow the fish to come back strongly year after year. And even if we start seeing more significant climate change in Alaska that perhaps makes this region less suitable for sockeye salmon over the long term, enough sockeye salmon, spawn in the wrong place that they can continue to find new habitats. And there's some early indication that salmon may be spreading further north in Alaska and up into the Arctic, or maybe some of the populations that have been there for a while and have been small are starting to do better. So we might be seeing a shift in the distribution of salmon northward as well, although it's very early days on that part.
And in 2014, when you were up there, there was just this incredible return of salmon. Can you describe that for us? And you know, and I also love your story of, you know, making sure that you don't run into bears. Hey,
yeah.
Hey, bear.
So that's a stream called Hanson Creek. It's in Bristol Bay. It's been studied for a long time. And in 2014, I was up there with my my oldest child. At the time, he was, I think, around 11 years old. And we were walking up the stream. And in this part of Alaska, there's a lot of grizzly bears. And they come to the streams to catch salmon. They're incredible at catching them, and they're incredibly dexterous at taking them apart and eating them. It's quite remarkable to watch. But you don't want to stumble onto a bear, especially a sow with cubs. It can be a dangerous thing to do. And the streams themselves have really dense vegetation, so you can't see very far. And so what you do in a situation like that is you try to let the bears know you're coming. So as you're walking along a stream, you keep shouting every, 30 seconds, every minute, "Hey, bear," and just let them know that you're there. If so, they can hear you coming and they can take whatever measures they need to get themselves prepared. And, I can't tell you how many times I've come up to like a gravel bar in the sun and seen like a flopping bloody salmon or droplets of water going off the pebbles into the brush, which tells us that there had been a bear there just moments before that we scared off the stream. In that particular situation, that stream had perhaps its best return ever. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think something like 10,000 salmon returned to that stream. And this is a stream that, you know, I don't know, 6 feet across at its widest. There's no part that you can't walk through on waders because it's too deep. This is a little tiny, tiny stream that, you know, meanders maybe a kilometer or two back into the forest and ends up in the tundra. The place that we got to was a spring-fed pond at the top of this that had thousands and thousands of salmon in it. And the water looked red and you easily could have walked across on the backs of the salmon. I've never seen them as dense as that in my life, but it shows you that when you have a healthy ecosystem, it can produce extraordinary returns of salmon.
Yeah, it was quite just the picture you painted of seeing that many salmon was just really, really fascinating and vivid and exciting. I'm curious as to what your take is on the salmon fishery here in the Pacific Northwest and Northern California. California just announced the other day that fishing inland for salmon is once again closed the second year in a row. What's your takeaway on what's going on with the Chinook salmon on the West Coast?
So I can't say in detail what's going on with the Chinook because I haven't looked at that closely. But what I can tell you is that I think that the overall pattern in the Northwest, it's explainable. And we can explain it by looking at how it's different from places like Bristol Bay. So one of the things that the researchers in Bristol Bay have looked at is how reliable are the returns of salmon to that system? And what they found is that the diversity in places like Bristol Bay make the returns of salmon more consistent from year to year. And it happens through what's called a portfolio effect. So if you've ever, you know, dealt with your retirement account and you were advised to have a diverse portfolio, the reason for that is that some stocks or bonds or whatever might be up at one time and others may be down at that same time. And that by having a diversity of investments, you essentially get a sort of a balancing out, a dampening of variation is what an ecologist would say, so that your returns tend to be fairly consistent over time. Well, in places like Bristol Bay, there's thousands of small-scale populations spread across a bunch of rivers and lakes, and the habitat's pretty much entirely intact. And what that means is that in any given year, one population might be experiencing what I was describing on Hanson Creek when I walked up there in 2014 with gangbuster returns. A stream, you know, a mile away might be having a poor year. But the combination of some places doing really well, some places having average returns, and some places having lower returns means that collectively, the whole system tends to do pretty well every year. In that same research, what the researchers looked at, they said, well, what would happen if you didn't have this kind of portfolio effect? And the answer is what you would expect would be sort of a boom and bust system, where some years there's lots of fish overall, some years there aren't very many fish. And the people who fish in that system would experience sort of high catches in one year and then low or no catches in another year. And it would bounce up and down, up and down, up and down. And if you look at what happens in places like the Columbia or the Sacramento River systems, they tend to behave more like that, which is they tend to have this sort of dynamic where they'll have a really good year or two, and then they'll have a really bad year or two, and the populations bounce up and down. Some of that can be explained just by this portfolio effect. Unfortunately, in the Northwest, a lot of the diversity of populations has been lost, and a lot of the populations that are there are maintained by hatcheries, which serve a purpose, but one of the problems with hatcheries is that they're not necessarily putting out genetically diverse fish, they're not necessarily putting them out at different times of the year, and so you get sort of those larger systems are acting more and more like one or a small number of populations rather than the thousands that they would have been historically.
Yeah, it's like the hatchery system is literally you're putting all your salmon eggs in one basket, so you're very vulnerable.
Yeah, it doesn't have to, but you know, I think oftentimes with hatcheries, the interest is in producing them more efficiently, and you know, producing like the biggest salmon and the ones that are going to have the you know highest probability of returning. But all of those decisions end up, at least, say the potential to reduce the diversity of the system. And what we've seen in Alaska is that diversity is actually the parameter that helps systems be more reliable.
Well, let's shift from salmon to trees. One of the things I really didn't know much about until I read your book was the American chestnut tree. Can you just briefly tell us that story? Because it's really interesting. For those of us on the West Coast, we really don't have that much experience with chestnut trees, but it's more of an East Coast thing. But I found it to be very, very interesting.
Yeah, and you mentioned Portland, Oregon a while earlier. There's actually some chestnut trees in Portland, Oregon that were the seeds were brought over, and they're some of the few sort of wild chestnut trees that are doing well in the world. But I don't know exactly where they are. I bet you could find out.
Now, are those American chestnuts or the Asian?
There are some American chestnuts. Ah. Yeah, there's a few in the Northwest. In any event, I didn't know much about the American chestnut either. I got interested in it because I talked to some colleagues and read a few papers about an interest in trying to create a genetically modified American chestnut to grow for conservation purposes. So this would be a GMO chestnut. And that piece caught my attention. And so I decided to do a little more research into what actually happened with chestnuts. And it's kind of a sad story. This tree was one of the most important East Coast trees. It was, you know, all the way from Ontario down through Mississippi, and especially in Appalachia. This was one of the primary forest trees. It was really important to people because it was a great tree for a really useful lumber that could be used for many different things, as well as its production of chestnuts. And there was a culture in the East of going and harvesting chestnuts every fall, storing them for the winter, selling them. So these were important to people for food. They were also important for economic opportunities. And they were also important for lots of wildlife that would come in and would eat the chestnuts, you know, bears and turkeys and things like that. In the early 1900s, there was a disease that was accidentally introduced. And what we understand now is that the disease likely came from different species of chestnut that were found in Asia that were imported for things like botanical gardens or yards, where people wanted to try a different kind of tree. And what they didn't realize is that with the trees that they brought in, they accidentally brought a fungal pathogen that causes something called chestnut blight. And the trees in Asia had co-evolved with this disease so that it was harmful to the trees, but the trees could fight back against the disease and survive over time. But the American chestnut tree had been evolving by itself without this disease for a really long time, and it was essentially caught unawares. It didn't have we talked about immune responses before, it didn't have the right tools in its immune response to fight this particular disease. And the disease was first observed in New York State, and over a period of about 20 years, it spread from there throughout the entire range of the American chestnut tree. And when I've talked to people who work on chestnuts, they can't say for certain, but it's possible that every single above ground structure that you would call a tree died. And this was billions of trees throughout these forests. It turns out that the whole tree didn't necessarily die, though. For a lot of individuals, the roots survived. And what would happen is that the roots would send out new suckers that would begin to grow and form a new tree. But by now, the pathogen had been established in the environment, and those suckers would just catch the disease again, and they would die. Now, this is a situation where if some American chestnut trees had had the right genes to fight the disease, you might have expected evolutionary rescue to happen. It's exactly the right kind of circumstance. Unfortunately, it looks like for the American chestnut trees, there just wasn't the right kind of genes in any population of those trees to have a reasonable chance of fighting the disease. So starting more than 100 years ago, people started saying, well, how can we bring our tree back? It's clearly not going to come back on its own. Are there things we can do to intervene? And early on, what people started doing was they would try and breed some of the trees that were still alive, but those were found to still be susceptible to the disease over the time, and that has largely been unsuccessful. But they were trying to do selective breeding and find better and better trees at surviving in the face of the disease. The next step they took was to say, wait a minute, maybe we could hybridize the Asian trees with the American trees and produce a new tree that has the characteristics of the American chestnut, but has the genes for fighting the disease coming from the Asian species of chestnut tree. And that kind of crossbreeding has been going on for more than 100 years, and it's produced some results where there are trees today that have the ability to withstand the disease far better than sort of wild American chestnut trees through that breeding. But it's also been slow, And it's also been much more complicated than people had imagined. A couple decades ago, some researchers started asking if there was another way of doing this. And what they were interested in was, could you use the tools of genetic engineering to add new genes to the American chestnut genome to help it survive in the face of this disease? And they first looked at the Asian chestnut species to see if they could decode what genes they had to fight it. And they found that it was actually just too complicated a problem. It looked like there were way too many genes responsible, and it's hard to do genetic engineering, and the more genes, the harder. But they did find, after looking in many different places, one gene that's worked quite well. And this is a gene from wheat. So, you know, if you eat wheat, you've probably eaten the product of this gene today. And it's an enzyme that breaks down one of the chemicals that are produced by the fungal pathogen. So wheat uses this gene to fight fungal pathogens. It's also found in things like chocolate and corn and lots of other plants. What the researchers were able to do was take a copy of that single gene and insert it into the genome of some American chestnut trees. And what they found is that those trees are actually much better at fighting off the blight and have the potential to survive and grow to adulthood. And so now we're in this situation where, at least the last time I checked, it still hasn't been approved, but they're seeking U.S. government, like FDA, USDA approval for growing these trees with this genetic modification more broadly. So we are on the brink of having our first conservation GMO.
Yeah, and of course, when a lot of people hear GMO, they have a negative reaction to that. And I'd just like to hear your take on what do you think about when you hear genetically modified organism?
I think people are right to ask questions about it because it is a meaningful difference in what, you know, sort of, I guess you could say, husbandry by people. We've been breeding things for our own benefit for a long, long time, which is why we have agricultural species. And we've done lots of crossings and we made lots and lots of new genetic combinations. And so I don't tend to think that new genetic combinations are inherently dangerous. We see them all the time. We produce them all the time. But the difference with genetic engineering is that it opens the door to doing genetic combinations that you couldn't get to through crossbreeding. For example, you're never going to get a chestnut tree and a wheat plant to crossbreed. And so to move that gene from one place to another is in some ways a more significant step of taking this gene from one evolutionary lineage and moving it over to another. It turns out that nature does actually do this. There are some special cases where nature does this kind of gene transfer. It's not very common, but it does exist in nature. So it's not entirely new. It's more based on something that does happen in nature. But to me, I think the really interesting question about these chestnut trees is to compare what the result is from the hybridization versus the genetic modification. So in the hybridization, you take two different species of tree, usually an Asian chestnut tree, an American chestnut tree, and you crossbreed them. In that case, in your first generation, half the genes of that new tree are coming from each of the parents. So there's something like 30,000 genes. That new tree has 15,000, you know, copies of genes from one parent and 15,000 from another. In the genetic modification, you're only adding a single new gene in this particular case. So I think when you look at what's going on genetically, it's actually a much smaller intervention to do genetic modification. The question then becomes, I think, you know, a values question, ethical question about whether you think it's right to be moving genes from one species to another. And I think people have valid reasons for thinking that's a bad idea. For me, if your goal is to get back an American chestnut tree and have it be as close to an American chestnut tree as possible, the genetic modification actually looks like a better answer to me. Some of the people who are working on this are combining the two. And they're starting to crossbreed the hybridized trees with the genetically modified trees to try and get even more ability to fight this disease. And I think what you've got with the American chestnut is a population that's really interested in having these trees back. And they've had to wrap their head around some very new technology and different ways of looking at conservation in order to get to the trees that they have right now that they'd like to start planting out more broadly. And while this is the first place where this is coming to a head, I don't in any way expect it to be the last. I think we're going to see more and more examples of things like genetic modification and cloning, which is starting to happen for conservation.
It's a sticky wicket. There's a lot involved and so many different ways of looking at it. And it also takes a long time to do something like this.
And if I could just jump in here quickly. one of the reasons I wanted to talk about these stories in the book is because I think in a lot of these cases, there aren't easy answers. It's not just a, this is the right thing, this is the wrong thing. At least I don't tend to see it that way. And what I wanted to do in some of those stories was help the readers sort of see the conundrum or see the trade-offs or explore their own sort of values on these different questions. So it sounds like you had some of that experience, which I think is great. Hopefully others will as well when they read the book, is they have the ability to ask themselves these questions.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with NYU professor and author Michael Medha-Webster about his book, The Rescue Effect, The Key to Saving Life on Earth. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with NYU Environmental Studies professor Michael Medha-Webster as we talk about his book, The Rescue Effect.
I've been working around ecology and conservation for a while now, and I think historically, in ecology, we tended to view natural systems as being at some sort of equilibrium, like that there was some sort of state that they were all working toward. You can think of it as like the old growth forest model of nature, and that left to its own devices, ecosystems will always sort of come back to the same state. And I think that's partly born out of a human tendency to see time in sort of decadal terms. And if you think about something like an old growth forest on the West Coast, it doesn't change much over a 10-year period or a 20-year period or a 30-year period. But you don't have to go back very far to see how much ecosystems have changed. For example, if you go back to the Pleistocene, you go back 15 or 20,000 years into the past, much of North America was covered under, you know, a mile thick ice sheet. It was scraped down to bedrock. And when those ice sheets retreated, the ecosystems were recreated. The species moved further northward. They recolonized all those areas and they created the patterns that maybe, you know, when we think back to sort of the historical ecosystems of North America, we might have in mind. And so it's easy to sort of come to this idea that ecosystems are supposed to look a certain way. They're supposed to work a certain way. But all you have to do is expand your time frame a little bit to see that that is not necessarily true in ecosystems, that they're always changing as the environment changes, as different species move through, as they evolve different capabilities. To be fair, it's happening much faster right now than it has during much of Earth's history. But the fact of change in and of itself is not surprising for ecosystems. And I think that as we're thinking about conservation, one of the sort of the important lessons that came to me from doing all the research on this book is that instead of trying to shun change and sort of see change as something that's inherently wrong or inherently bad, there are some cases where we maybe want to accelerate change or we want to facilitate change because it is that change that is signaling to us the rescue effect is working. Species are moving to new locations. They're evolving new capabilities. They're developing new relationships with other species. And on the whole, I'd say that's a good thing. It shows that nature is resilient. It may not always produce patterns we like. And, you know, in conservation, there are always going to be opportunities where we want to prevent invasive species or try and bring some species back. And maybe fighting against the things that are playing out in nature. I think that's fine. But I think it's risky if we get into our head that there is some correct way for nature to look or function.
Yeah, well, let's talk about one of your favorite ecosystems, coral reefs, because I can tell from reading the book that you just absolutely love coral reefs. Tell us about some of your work on coral reefs and some of the challenges they are facing that we hear about so often, like coral bleaching due to the warming, acidifying water, and some of the ways that the rescue effect is, you know, perhaps starting to kick in to help coral reefs.
Sure. And you've identified me correctly as a fan of coral reefs. I actually decided I was going to be a marine biologist when I was 4 years old because I wanted to work on coral reefs. And I've essentially been, you know, trying to get around and learn first to understand coral reefs and then more recently try to figure out how to save coral reefs around the world. I did my PhD studying coral reefs in the 1990s, late 90s in the Bahamas. And during that time period, we had a major El Nino event, the 97-98 El Nino, one of the biggest the world has ever seen. And I was studying the fish. I like fish a lot. I'm a fish biologist by training. And The reefs where the fish that I was studying were living on started bleaching that year. And bleaching is when coral, which usually has color to it. In the Caribbean, a lot of the colors are sort of oranges and yellows, mustardy colors. But in other places, there's blue corals and reddish corals, all sorts of different colors. The color in the coral comes from a symbiotic alga that lives inside the coral tissue. So the coral is an animal. It's essentially an animal that farms algae inside its body. And it's this symbiosis that makes a coral reef what it is. The corals can grow. They build these rocky skeletons. They build the reef through this symbiosis with algae. In coral bleaching, there's a breakdown in the relationship between the coral animal and the algae that lives in its tissues. And this is usually triggered today by water temperatures that are higher than they've been in recent times, where once the water gets really hot, the communication and the relationship between the algae and the coral begins to break down. And the coral starts basically getting sick, and in a last-ditch effort to survive, it expels its algae. So it'd be like if you were, you know, growing a crop, if you dug up all your crops. So it loses its primary source of food. If the temperature doesn't come down after that, what happens is the corals can die. So first they turn white, and then they might die. Prior to the 1970s, this is something that was almost never had been observed on the planet. It wasn't something that coral reef biologists really thought about or understood. But since the 1970s, as the world has gotten warmer and warmer coral reefs have bleached. At this point in our history, pretty much every coral reef on the planet has bleached, and some of them are bleaching almost annually. Some of the reefs that I've worked on in Honduras, they bleach something like, you know, 6 times in 8 years. So this is becoming the new normal as air temperatures and thus water temperatures are getting higher and higher. And so for corals, we're facing a really scary situation where it's possible that corals are going to disappear from the world, at least in terms of these coral reefs that are dominated by corals, and corals are building that structure. And so a lot of my work has been to try and understand, is there any hope for corals in the future? Have we changed climate so much already? Are we locked into so much warming going forward that corals are more or less doomed, or are there things we can do about it? So I've actually partnered with other scientists and conservation professionals to try and sort of model a coral reef that we can use to test scenarios about how much climate change do we think coral reefs can handle, and what can we do from a management perspective to try and help them. And the general answer seems to be this, which is if we do nothing about climate change, the corals are probably going to be more or less lost from reefs. And this is because the evolutionary rescue can't happen fast enough if we do nothing to mitigate climate change. But if we do start mitigating climate change in the decades to come, and we can essentially bend that curve so that it doesn't warm so quickly, and that we get to a point where temperature levels out, our models at least predict that corals are largely, they might be able to pull through that. And we might be able to have coral reefs recover once the climate has stabilized. In addition, there's things we can do to help corals locally through, you know, making sure they've got clean water and certain fish that help keep the corals healthy. And so there's levers that we can pull in terms of doing good local management as well as dealing with climate change. For me, there's two ways of looking at these results. One is the urgency side of it, which is absolutely true, which is if we don't do something, we risk losing, you know, one of the most diverse and I would say miraculous ecosystems on the planet. On the flip side, that we still have agency here, which is there are things we can do to make a difference in the future of coral reefs. And to me, that's motivating, which is we haven't lost on coral reefs yet. We could lose if we don't do anything about it, but we have the ability to affect what happens to them in the future.
Yeah, we're like a baseball team that's behind, but we still have at-bats left.
Yeah, that nicely said, yeah.
And one of the things you said about corals that I thought was just perfect to describe them is they're hunters and farmers. So for people who don't really understand corals, could briefly tell us about what that means.
Yeah, so I talked about them being farmers a minute ago. They essentially have clear bodies. They make rocky skeletons to essentially create their space on the reef. And they house algae in those clear bodies in order to be a source of food. It would be for, if we did that, if you were hungry, you could just go lie out in the sun for a little bit and the sun would pass through your skin and feed algae under your skin and give you a meal. That's basically what Most corals do. And most of the ones that are building reefs are doing that. But it isn't their only source of food. Corals are also hunters. They've got little sting cells on their surfaces that are like coiled poisonous harpoons. And so if something touches a coral, you have this spring-loaded harpoon that shoots and can kill small animals, or at least stun them long enough for the coral to basically reel them in and then swallow them. So they're sort of voracious, vicious predators for, especially if you're a tiny little zooplankton that's swimming by on the reef, corals can be very effective at hunting and killing those organisms for food. And it's this combination of hunting and farming that give them the edge historically on coral reefs. Coral reefs, people like to dive on coral reefs because they're warm. They also like it because the water is really clear. You can see very far. And if you look at the coast of the Northwest, for example, the water tends to be green or brown. That's because there's lots of nutrients in that water, and it's fueling microscopic algae that are floating in that water. That's perfectly normal, but coral reefs tend to have clear water because they have very little nutrient in the water. And so the corals have figured out how to get nutrients by being a hunter, feed those nutrients to their crops, and create this sort of self-contained system for being able to grow relatively quickly in an area that's sort of like a desert underwater.
And are there some tools that are being used to get corals that are more heat resistant implanted into some of these reefs?
It's certainly being looked at. There are a lot of people doing research trying to figure out how you can find and help corals that are good at surviving at higher temperatures. Higher temperatures are not the only threat to coral reefs, but if, for example, you can go to places that have unusually warm reefs and you find corals living there, it tells you that they're capable of it. Maybe those corals have the right genetic combination to be able to survive in the future. And if you took those corals and you bred them in tanks, you could put more of them out on the reef and sort of put a thumb on the scale of evolutionary rescue, trying to make it occur a little bit faster. So that's one way you can do it, by trying to find those combinations in nature. Another way to do it would be to take them into tanks and breed them and subject them to higher temperatures, see which ones live, and then breed those. This is more like what we think of in agriculture when we're trying to select for certain plants or certain animals. There are also people who are starting to investigate, can you use the tools of genetic modification like have been used for the American chestnut tree on corals? Although that stuff is still pretty early days. And so the overall idea here is maybe there are ways of accelerating things like evolution for corals. And we've done some modeling of that as well. And it looks like if you can find those corals and you can put a lot of them out on the reef, you probably can also speed the process up that way. It's going to take a while. It'll be expensive, and you have to do a lot of it. But it's another tool that's available for people who are trying to figure out how to keep corals on reefs for the future.
One of the things that you and I talked about previously and is in towards the end of the book is the perception that we have that we're losing species left and right, that we're in the midst of this mass extinction event that we're causing. But you have a slightly different perspective on that. I wish you'd share it with us.
Sure. So people tend to get very concerned about loss of species, and I agree with that concern. I think, there's a moral issue with allowing species to disappear from the planet because of us. That said, I think we get caught up in this idea that we've already lost a large fraction of the Earth's species diversity, and, we're losing it at an alarming rate. Again, with most of these things, there's two ways to look at it. One way to look at it is to say, well, how much has this changed? So, for example, if you could figure out how often did species go extinct prior to humans dominating the planet, and how often are they going extinct today? People have tried to estimate those things. And the answer is somewhat alarming. So it looks like the species extinction rate has gone up something like 1,000-fold because of us. So that's a really big increase. But it's an increase of a very small number, because the extinction rate normally is not that high. And so what's happening is that it is going up very quickly, but we actually haven't lost very many species yet. And if you look at the number of known species that have disappeared from the planet, it's some small fraction of 1% of the species that have been lost to date. If you look at the number of species that we know are at higher risk of extinction today, it's something like 2% of the species that are on the planet. Those are small compared to the number of species that we know of, but they're big in an absolute sense. So there's a lot of things that are at risk and a lot of things that people really care about. So there's sort of two ways of looking at this. We are not in a place where we are losing a large fraction of the diversity of species on Earth yet. That said, the rates are going up and we should be trying to get in front of it. And so this is another place where I think, you know, one of the key ideas is agency. We haven't gotten to the point where we've lost everything here. We haven't even lost a large share of the species that are out there. And we have time and resources and tools. If we're willing to invest in them, we can determine the outcome here and we can keep most species on the planet.
Well, Michael Medow-Webster, it's been really fascinating to talk to you about The Rescue Effect and this wonderful book and your take on things. Before we let you go, what do you most enjoy about your work in environmental science?
What really motivates me is the idea that we can do something to help make the world a better place for all these different creatures and organisms that I care so much about. So to me, it's really this idea that came up earlier of agency, which is we have the ability to shape our future. And for me, I find that really motivating.
Well, thanks for joining us and sharing your expertise and all these thought-provoking ideas. It's a book that definitely makes you think.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks again to our guest, Professor of Practice in the Department of Environmental Studies at New York University, Michael Medow-Webster. His book, The Rescue Effect, The Key to Saving Life on Earth, was published by Timber Press in 2022 and is available at most major booksellers or order it at your local community bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.